and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. Once again, I am Martin, Crown Prince of Charisma, and with me, the King of the Casters, as usual, the man with the... Well, Brett, I'm not even going to say it because it wouldn't be true in this case.
Nope, not at
all.
You
are Mr. Brett. You are Mr. Brett Podcast. But while one of our guests once said you were the man with the golden voice, I mean...
Wow.
This is... A truly golden voice we're talking to today.
Absolutely. No, I mean, he sang with the Nylons. He is he's a jazz singer. He's a singer-songwriter. He's a wonderful solo artist that we do absolutely enjoy his music. It's Mika Barnes. Mika, how are you?
Oh, I'm so much better now, like with an intro like that. I mean, how am I going to get out of my room when my head would be way too swollen?
Well, honestly, though, I mean, your music, your singing is fantastic, and it's been great to kind of go back and listen to a lot of the songs. But I mean, Vegas Breeze, your new album, it's wonderful to hear your versions of a lot of these songs as well, because they're such great standards, and then to be able to hear you kind of have your take on them, especially like That's Life and the way you sped it up, wonderful stuff. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh man, I'm thrilled to be here talking to you guys. Really happy to be here with you.
Well, thank you. But yeah, so let's talk about Vegas Breeze. I mean, obviously great album. So, you know, what then brought about the concept of doing these songs?
So this is a weird thing. I was on a cruise, which I'm not really a cruise guy, but I was, you know, I had a couple of days off, and what did I bring along with me? But, you know, a pod, let's see, an iPod full of songs. And I just kind of loaded them, you know, just before I jumped on the boat. And it was like, oh, I kind of rediscovered like Mel Torme, Jack Jones, Tony Bennett. You know, I kind of had a moment where I was like, oh my God, the dudes. You know, like, and part of that is I grew up with a little bit of a thing about Sinatra. Like, I love some of his records, but I don't love his personality. So that's just my own thing. I find him a little bit, he just reminds me of like his generation of white guy. I'm like, ah, you guys, you're over. Stop it. And, you know, stop trying to rule the planet with your swagger. And, you know, so I always had a really visceral reaction to the Rat Packy thing. And so I always stayed away from Vegas Showroom, you know, Rat Packy material. But these other singers, you know, the Nat King Cole, the Sammy out of the Rat Pack, he's a dude I really admire. You know, and like, I started to go, wait a minute, these songs are great. And the vocal delivery is all swaggery, full of punch and pow. And I was like, coming off of the New York Stories album, which is a very romantic, intimate kind of balladeer kind of affair, you know, which is certainly a side of my personality, but there's more to, you know, there's more to me. I also come from a, you know, a bluesy kind of R&B thing, and I have a lot of, you know, rock and roll swagger in my thing. So Vegas, being a Vegas, sort of taking the mantle of these entertainers and kind of trying it on my own shoulders, I looked at these songs from that era, and my band kept going, you're bringing like Vegas Showroom songs. I'm like, yeah, I'm so attracted to this stuff. And they were like, oh, come on, let's do it. We're going to do it. Let's do it. So we all got on the bandwagon, and I think the results speak for themselves. The guys really dedicated to making the arrangements top notch, you know?
Oh, and they are. I mean, the playing on this album is spectacular. Like, just the, you know, the bass lines and then the piano. I mean, oh, just wonderful.
Well, you just named the two secret weapons in my band. You know, with Russ Boswell, you know, he's a blues player at heart. He can play everything and anything from Corey Hart all the way to jazz. But he's the guy that once he comes up with the bass line, I know we've landed. And we're not landed until Russ has got the bass line. And it has to be singable by your average human being. If an average guy can walk down the street singing Russ's bass line, then I know we've got our record. And it's as simple as that. And then when it comes to Michael Shand, he's the most explosive you know, harmonically explorative kind of piano player. So not only is he a flashy soloist, but he'll get in there and reharmonize a song specifically for the singer. So working with him has been a real career high as well. And those guys are the mainstay of my band, that's for sure.
Yeah, because I really noticed it with Come Back to Me. Just, you know, I was listening to the album and then like Come Back to Me came on and it was just like, oh, whoa, there's something going on here. And it's more, you know?
Yeah, it's more. That's it. It's like, what is Vegas? More.
Yeah.
You know, louder, faster, harder, you know, quieter, more sad, more explosive, more celebratory. Yeah, that particular tune was a bit of a journey for me, man. I brought it to the band. I like the up-temponess of it, and I like the wordiness of it. I like the message of it. It's from a Broadway show, and it just ended up like they played the heck out of it. Like, we took it at a breakneck tempo, a little bit show-offy for the guys, but for me, I was like just trying to just to stay easy in the saddle and keep that song from running away from me was like all I could do for for quite a while. And then finally we cut a demo of it, or the guys had laid down a live off the floor version of the instrumental, which is how we did the whole album, live off the floor for the band. And then but my vocal that I cut was like careful. It was like as if I didn't know the song. So I went, oh shit. And my wonderful engineer, John Beetle Bailey, who, you know, he comes with so many Junos attached to his name. How does he get in the door? You know, but I just went, okay, we got to reapproach this. And finally I realized, like, the guys are playing like a jazz band. Why am I singing like I'm in a Broadway show? Like, stop it. So I just went back to my jazz singing world and, you know, tried to ride the band and be with the band. And I think it came out a lot better than it. I'm not playing anybody the original vocal, I'll tell you that.
Go ahead, Brent.
Okay, I was just going to ask what it was like to try to write a song to be put into an album like this.
Boy, you are, I'm telling you, you're just asking great questions. That was probably the two original songs are probably the biggest contrast in terms of how that material got included. I'll put it to you this way. Appointment with the Blues, I wrote when I was a teenager. I tried it on the band. We made a couple of adjustments. It was in like butter, and the horn arrangement was built around us. I'm telling you, by Don Brightup, who's just an amazing arranger. And it was just the easiest thing on earth. Didn't change much. It was an easy peasy decision. Appointment with the Blues. You're on a bar stool. It's 3 a.m. You lost all your money and you lost your girl. There you go. Right? The other tune was a struggle. It was a melody my brother Daniel had written with me years ago, and I could never get the lyric right. I had this generic kind of, you know, remember the songs that were introduced, written by like Irving Berlin or Gershwin, that were in, you know, the Fred and Ginger movies, and they'd have this, dance with me, I want my arms around you. Like, it was all that schmaltzy 30s stuff, right? I wanted a tune like that. So my brother and I went after it, and then I couldn't land a lyric that wasn't basically just a ripoff. So we just put the tune away, and then when I was looking at Vegas tunes, I couldn't find a cover tune that worked. The closest was Viva Las Vegas, which I do live, but I just didn't like our version for the album. So I went back to that old melody, and we took it, and instead of swinging it, we did a 60s Bacharach pop, sort of bossa nova pop thing, like kind of, it's 1967, and it's a bossa nova pop song about coming, spending a weekend in Vegas, Bacharach style. So I started to write the lyric with the idea that it was going to be our title track and kind of express, you know, a lot of what the public imagination thinks of when we think of Vegas, you know, the big getaway, the big win, you know, freedom from your boring life, you know, doesn't cost much, but like you can be like a big, big mucky muck and you gamble at the big table and come away a winner, you know, like fall in love and get married at the stupid, you know, Elvis chapel, like, you know, like all the mythology of the runaway fun you can have in Vegas. I wanted to embody that in one song and kind of cast that so it would cast its neon glow over the rest of the album. And I feel like we got it, but, you know, you never know. I don't know. What's your guys' take on that tune?
I really like the tune, and you know, because I do have a fondness for that era. I mean, I wasn't born in the 60s, but I do have a fondness for that whole, you know, like you were talking about. And then when you put it to the music video, which is really the point where I'm like, oh yeah, that extra sells it, because suddenly now you have this video that has this old 60s look to it, and, oh, cool. And it just really kind of marries it all together.
Yeah, I mean, for me, go ahead, man. Yeah, no, for me, I mean, the thing about the album is it's a full listening experience, right? It's an album, one of those albums, put on the headphones and close your eyes. And it's not one song, that it's the whole experience of the way that it flows into each other. I mean, this classic sound still to this day, while it's not as prevalent in media and pop culture, there's something about it that is just timeless and just takes you to a moment and a place of, I don't know, I find of tranquility.
Wow, that is cool to hear you say, because I know what you mean. It's almost like the bigness of the sound and the lushness of the orchestration, and there's a kind of a dynamic personality that you get from the music that lets it kind of take center stage in a way that a lot of our sort of more mainstream jazz acts, like say Diana Krall or Michael Bublé, like they work great at a dinner party. They don't have to take the main focus. And this record is a little bit pushy. It's a little bit, it's a bit of a bully. It says, no, listen to me now.
Which is okay.
Yeah, you know, it's all right. I'm good with it. Like, I'm that kind of a performer, right? So, like, it works for my personality.
No, I think this is definitely, I mean, obviously you have to put out singles, but this is definitely one that you want to listen to the full album. You want to get the real experience, I think.
I really appreciate that. And I appreciate especially what you're saying about the video, because there was another video with another single that we had planned, and the video we got, I won't get into the story, but it became something we couldn't complete, and it was because COVID shut us down. We had to do a reshoot of a sequence that didn't work out for us with the lighting, and it was like, we can't gather, we're screwed. So I shifted, I pivoted, as they say.
Right? Wonderful.
And kind of at the last minute, and went, okay, we're going with a different single and we're going with a different video. And my team was really awesome about making the changes quickly. Working with Carlos Coronado as my video director has been a really fruitful collaboration. And I'm really proud of that crazy, you know, sort of old Vegas vibe that you get from that video. That makes me happy.
Mm-hmm. First off, I just have to, before we go any further, I just have to say how much I love Nat King Cole. All right, so that's just to put that out there. I just love Nat.
Understandable.
King Cole. Now, this is the second time you used Indiegogo to fund, help fund a campaign on there for the album. So, what brought you to that in the first time, and how was it different? How was it different this time than it was previously?
Well, I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk about this, especially if there's any fellow artists out there who are listening. And my team came to me and said, because I have a really creative marketing director that I've worked with, and he said, we're going to do a crowdfunding campaign for the last album and New York Stories. And I said, I am never going to do a crowdfunding campaign. I said no, unequivocally, it will never happen. And then, as you can see, I was convinced. And how he convinced me was the simple thing of this. He said, no, he said, it's not the money you're making, it's creating a community of people around your project who are going to be active. They're going to be liking and sharing and posting and telling their friends. And you're beginning a village of support, which every release needs, especially if you start out indie. I looked him in the eye and I went, I'm going to hate this. And he went, yes, but you're going to do it. So I did it. And you know what? Not only was it a small army of supporters, but the money came in really useful too.
Like, amazing.
Hello. Yeah. And there's money at the end of it. So when it came time to look at the Indiegogo campaign for Vegas Breeze, I will tell you that we raised the money quicker, more money raised quicker, and I was much more comfortable saying, hey guys, here's my Indiegogo campaign. And it ended up paying for like some of the most expensive thing is the photo shoot and getting the album cover designed and, you know, taking care of all the clothes. And we shot in Montreal, tricking out a couple of studios to, you know, to give you the Vegas feel. We did not shoot in Vegas, but like, you know, that's flying my stylist and to Montreal. Like, it's, you know, so the Indiegogo campaign was very important. And I will be doing one for the next record, I guarantee you. It's a wonderful way to build, build support.
Oh, that's really interesting for sure. Plus, you know, of course, now you've also got the virtual tour. So, I mean, you really seem like you're actually on the edge of, you know, really being able to kind of know what people want and or at least attempting to find new ways of giving it to them.
You know, Brett, I really thank you for that. I will tell you, there was a freaking crazy moment where I was like, I pulled the lever. We're releasing in June. There's no way that we can possibly gather anywhere. And this record's going to sink without a trace unless I extend the story. And I thought about all the beautiful venues that I wasn't going to get a chance to play. And I just thought, no, I am going to get a hold of them and see if they want to live stream for free from their Facebook page so that I'm right in their community. And I have to say, like, you know, my team was incredibly responsive. They were really, you know, they pivoted quickly. And we ended up, you know, I humbly say that we ended up being sort of first to the table with the concept of a virtual tour, especially across Canada. And it's done really well for us in terms of, you know, collecting eyeballs for this music. It's what gave us the number one record. It stayed top of the iTunes charts for a week. And that's partly because I was touring, you know. And I have to say, like, I'm now kind of in love with the concept. I walk over to my closet and find another suit and go over to my piano and sing into an iPhone. And then when it's all done, I go and walk in my neighborhood for an ice cream. Hey.
That's a pretty darn good day.
Well, it's a lot better than sitting in an airport, I'll tell you that. You know, it's not financially viable, but I'm going to, the next outing will be with my band and my trio, and we will be asking for donation and or ticket price and working with the venues, across the country again, as well as Europe. And we're looking at the U.S. as well. So we're going to continue the concept. It seems to have worked for us really well. I do my last date tomorrow.
Are you saying you're never going on live for a tour again?
Oh, my God. I am dying to get back. I'm sure every musician you've talked to is just, like, hungry for it. You know, it's everything I can do not to run out on a Queen Street in Toronto and start singing to people.
Well, but that's the thing, right? Like, I've seen that as an option as well, as, like, kind of singing from a balcony and just having people come to like, stand outside, you know?
It's totally. Like... Yes. People are doing it. And, but, you know, when the time comes and we can gather, I will absolutely be first. I'll be in Calgary before you can say lickety split. Oh, they're opening up the venue. Mika Barnes.
Well, then Mo and I are going to be first in line for that one.
Awesome. That's great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That would be, I mean, you know, I'm sure that a lot of what, you know, for any artist, right, a lot of what drives you is that one-on-one interaction with a fan where they can tell you, you know, an yes. experience that you've gotten from the music. What are some of the most inspirational stories you've heard where people have been touched by your music? I'm sure there's got to be many over the years.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there's two that I'd like to tell you. One is from the New York Stories album, there's a song called Some Other Man. And it's basically, I was in the middle of a romance that, I was at the beginning of a romance and I wasn't sure where it was going. I was kind of nervous. And I wrote the tune like at 3 a.m. I couldn't sleep. And I was kind of emotionally really at my wit's end. And that song was a way to release all my emotions and kind of, you know, get it all out. And it's weird. I'm very proud of many of the songs I've written. But out of all the songs I've written recently, that one gets the biggest response. People can feel how visceral the emotions are in it. And it's a very simple song. You know, some other man may end up with you. I may not be that man that ends up with you, but I'm going to love you anyway. I love you anyway, you know. And it's been very profound to hear people's feedback. And then the other thing is, and you guys, you'll recognize this from anybody who's been in an established act. The minute I hit a Nylons cover in my set, right, everybody melts. And like, I don't in any way resent that. I love it. When I was in the Nylons, we opened for Ms. Gladys Knight, one of everyone's favorite R&B singers, right? She was delicious to work with, such a warm individual, just like her singing voice. She was just as warm, you know? And I watched her every night sing every song you wanted Gladys Knight to sing. In, you know, she squeezed some of them into the big medley, that's fine, but she sang every single one. And I thought, that's our job. Give you the memories that you associate with that music. So I try to work Nylon songs into every set. In fact, my next album is going to be a collection that includes jazz rearrangements of some Nylon tunes in 50s, 60s. Sort of R&B and rock and roll, because it's so to have been part of a legendary group like that is to essentially have been part of people's lives. People run up to me and go, you were my first cassette, you were my first concert, my mom took me to the concert. You know, that's profound shit. You don't want to like discount that by going, oh, well, I'm doing my own stuff now. Like, yeah, you are, but how did we get to know you? Oh, you were a Nylon. I'm so proud of it. I can't even tell you. So that's one of the things that I love when people go, he sang that song, you know?
Well,
makes me happy.
It's interesting, too, because that is one of the questions that I was going to ask you about the idea of, like even in the introduction, it's just like, oh, ex-Nylon, Mika Barnes. And it's just like, I always wondered how that kind of attaches itself and how it feels to be attached to those kind of things. So, you know, you answered that now, which is great.
Right on. Yeah.
I try
to guess what's coming and just take care of it, you know?
Perfect. good work. What am I thinking now?
You're tired of talking to me now.
Not at all. He might be, but I'm sure not.
Awesome.
I was just interested because, you know, the Nylons and the a cappella singing is so different than most. So, like, and obviously you are a vocal teacher and a great singer in your own, like, for sure. But, like, how is it that it's different to sing jazz, to sing a cappella, to sing pop, that kind of thing?
Well, okay, so that's the million-dollar question. First of all, a cappella is like mathematics. You have to sing your part, you know, or the arrangement doesn't work. So I found that initially a huge challenge when I joined the group because I wasn't used to that kind of harmony singing, that precision, you know, big giant learning curve. And singing pop was, you know, which the Nylons are a pop group. I was really new to it. And I remember when Mark Connors, who was the tenor in the group, turned to me and he said, you don't know. For instance, the Burt Bacharach tunes that Dionne Warwick made famous. He said, you're not really familiar with that canon, are you? And I said, I probably know one or two of those songs. He said, so that's like probably the quintessential moment where singer and songwriter and the culture all come together in this perfect moment of sophisticated pop, you know, pop songs. And I was like, okay, teach me. And he like, it was back in the day, so he cut a cassette for me of, you know, the Dionne Warwick tunes. I was like, oh, this is delicious. And, but, you know, that was new to me. I had come up on Aretha Franklin and Billie Holiday, Nat King Cole, Fats Waller, you know. I like funk and R&B and certainly punk rock and rock and roll, but I hadn't really entered the pop sweepstakes, and that's what the Nylons taught me. And then, you know, going back to my jazz roots was just heaven for me, because, I mean, jazz is about the moment. It's about improvisation. It's about your musical personality, and it's about taking a risk and being willing to commit and liberate yourself inside that commitment. And so it's always challenging to the artist to stay on their toes and to stay in you know, sort of a musically authentic place. I love jazz. Jazz is my métier. It's where I live. It's where I belong.
Given that story, given how you're, you know, taught all this after you get in them, how did you get in them? What was the, yeah. What, right? You know, yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it sounds like, the, you know, I mean, obviously you can sing it, but if you didn't know the history of what they were doing it properly, then was it an audition or a recommendation, or how did it come together?
So really great that you're asking, because I was in some ways the perfect choice, in some ways just so the wrong choice. So I'll tell you that I had a very good, solid reputation as a live performer. I had not yet committed recordings that had worked out for me as an artist. When I was in my 20s when the guys called me. Their manager called me up and said, we know where you live. We know we've heard of you. We've been thinking about you, and we'd like you to come in and talk to us. So the first couple of audition days were really lovely. The guys were very warm and very inviting, and I wasn't asked to stretch terribly far. They gave me a couple of parts to try, which I did fairly badly, but they could tell that I was a quick study, you know, because, and they really grilled me. They're like, you know, if you join the group, you're going to be singing mostly backup. That's basically the gig, you know. It's not, you don't get to just be a lead singer. And I grew up loving vocal groups, starting with Lambert, Kendricks, and Ross, with the best jazz vocal group ever, and then, you know, moving into people like the Pointer Sisters and Manhattan Transfer. I love vocal groups, so, and I had loved the Nylons, so there was no question that I was interested. And what I did have was, I already had my stage chops together. I could perform on a concert stage. They knew I could move. I knew how to dance a little. And I think it was about my personality more than anything, because, you know, being a Nylon, it's all about personality. It's like, were the Nylons the most precise singers in the world? No, we were not. Were we, you know, like, were the arrangements as tricky as, say, take six? No. But we were showmen, top to bottom. We gave you a show. We sang our asses off for you. But you walked away with our personalities being as much important as the songs. And in that way, I think that's probably why, you know, they did give me a 3-week boot camp to kind of, like, get me into the world of singing harmony and dancing, you know, doing the choreography, which was all new to me. I had studied dance a little, you know, just as a performer, but I wasn't a dancer by any means. And they all came from musical theater backgrounds, so I really had a very steep learning curve. And it was like going to university, guys. I loved it. I learned so much so quickly. And then through the years that I was with them, I was able to hone that craft. And I'll always be thankful for the opportunity. This was, you know, made me who I am.
So what are the things then that you learned from the Nylons that you still incorporate into your act today, especially virtually? No, I'm just kidding on that one.
You know, I think trusting myself to be authentic with the audience, that was a really big lesson with the Nylons, because I didn't know whether I would be embraced for who I am because I was replacing a founding member. And I found the audience really embraced me. So I got a lot of confidence from that. And I think that is probably the most important thing that I bring to the table. Also, it stretched me vocally right from the bottom of my range to the very top. And I still use, I still use that wide range in my work today. And that they really concretized my ability. I mean, I've been working with vocal coaches since then, but I definitely learned how to like use my entire range at that time. And the other thing is, taking the audience on a ride that's good for them rather than just taking, doing a show that's self-indulgent. It's all about what I want to do. You know, there are some days you just want to sing nothing but ballads, or you want to just sing the blues, or you want to sing, you know, all your own tunes and no cover tunes. Well, the audience wants to be taken on a ride, and they need that journey to have a variation in tempo, a variation in subject matter, emotional subject matter. And, you know, don't sing one, all one style, like move it around so people have variety. And cover tunes are incredibly important to making a set successful. Because if you're seeing me for the first time and I'm singing all my own material that you've never heard, I'm going to lose you by song three, no matter how good I am, unless I'm Bob Dylan, you know? And, you know, like, I'm not Bob Dylan, so let's get real. Like, my songs are, you know, I can stand behind them, but then there's That's Life. That's a durable tune. Perhaps we might sing that.
You know? Somehow it makes me remember, I seem to, Brett, tell me if I'm wrong, but didn't you go see Bob Dylan and he didn't play any of his familiar songs? And it wasn't
he didn't play his familiar songs. He played the songs, but he actually turned his back to the audience for the vast majority of the concert and didn't actually reference the crowd. And so it's funny when you talk about Bob Dylan, and it's just like, yeah, I got lost at a Bob Dylan show.
Bob. And the thing is, it's weird. We weirdly still respect him, even though he disrespects us.
Because you can't not respect him. He is Bob freaking Dylan.
Yeah, but I feel like we're in a bad relationship then.
Because he's this great lyricist, although a terrible poet, and here's a funny story off the topic, but I have his book, Tarantula, which is a book of his poetry, and it's horrible. It's this, like, the only reason I keep it is because I consider it to be the second worst poetry on the face of the planet, next to Sean Penn's poetry. But it's funny to go back and look at and think, like, how is it that a man writes these genius lyrics that just speak to so many people, and then he writes this shit, you know?
Oh my god. See, this is the problem. Like, Patti Smith, Bob Dylan, who else? People that have been lionized as writers. I think probably Lucinda Williams. You think of people who, like, have been touted as the greatest of their generation, and then they're allowed, over the age of 60, they start to, you know, peddle the piddle. And you're like, oh, please, this is like ramblings of a once drug-addled mind, and I don't need to hear them anymore. And you know what? That doesn't mean that they haven't created works of brilliance or won't again. But I know it's one of those things. I'm glad I was never legendary.
But, you know, at the same time, like, I mean, it's so important to be a performer, and you know, when you talk about being able to like go out and kind of command the stage, and you know, and that's what Bob Dylan didn't do for me. I'm not saying that at a certain point in his career that he wouldn't have, but you know, I think that it's so important to be a showman, and that's something that you obviously bring to the table.
It's weirdly in my blood. Like, I can't explain it. I had a choice. Was I going to go after being a singing, dancing actor? Or was I going to work in the cabarets when I was a kid? And the cabaret work took off. Within like 6 months to a year, I was one of the more popular acts in Toronto as a teenager. And I thought, oh, okay, well, this is working. And then, you know, I would get hired to be in shows as an actor, but they weren't the big shows. They were the smaller shows. I wasn't a good fit because I'm giant, right? I'm real tall. And I was a loony, big, skinny, kooky guy. You know, I just wasn't your lead. And there was just, you know, I didn't really know how to make that work. So, it, you know, music called me. And I mean, I got to tell you guys, like, how lucky was I, age 12, 13, cutting my teeth on the jazz standards as a kid, meant by the time I was 18, I was able to, like, give you know, a fairly decent rendition of the classics. And, you know, that puts you on a certain track. People see you a certain way. And I'm frankly glad for the way my career has unfolded.
Well, yeah, then, like, how important was it to grow up in such a musical family?
It was everything. I mean, I teach kids that come from families that aren't musical, and it's harder for those kids because their parents are not going to understand. And also, the kid isn't necessarily going to feel like they can make a living at it. Whereas I looked at my dad, who was making a living from composing classical music for the symphony hall, and my mom, whose mother was a concert pianist, my mom wrote for television. She wrote Mr. Dress-Up, right? So I was like, oh, so I can be myself and make a living at being me. Fantastic. Let's do it.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I've not really thought of it like that personally. You always think, like, you put in the time, you put in the hard work, and you hope for the best. But
right.
But yeah, I mean, it's such a different mentality to kind of realize that this is, like, yes, music, there is a career in music that can be had.
Right. It really helps, especially when you're younger. Like, when I was in my early 20s, like, there was nobody would have said, oh, you're going to do well. But I just had this weird confidence about, like, I mean, I was as insecure as any young performer is, trying to prove myself, trying to figure out who I was. But I did have a kind of a unique style of performing and delivery and a musical personality that was pretty well formed young. And so people were very complimentary and very supportive early. So besides my parents, you know, the culture I was in got really supportive, and that was great. And a lot of the theater people that I was working with understood that I was like a cabaret entertainer. So they came and they kind of really supported that. And that gave me a lot of confidence early in the game.
And what's really cool about hearing that is, I mean, a lot of parents who are in the entertainment industry just want to dissuade their kids from getting into it because it can be such a hard way to make a living. There is no guarantee of success.
Yeah, that is the truth. But luckily, my parents both really, they encouraged me to be the best I could be. They were like, get the best teachers you can, you know, work hard at this. And they encouraged me to just grow into the best possible artist. And I think that really set me on my path because I still study. I was studying with a voice coach up till a couple of years ago.
That's really interesting. You know, you studying with a voice coach and yet you teaching others. I mean, that seems like an interesting dichotomy in that, but at the same time, it makes perfect sense that you want to get better, so therefore you are even a better teacher.
You know, there's in the musical theater world, if you're a star performer, you will go and work with your coach when you get a new role. And I'm talking about the Tony Award winning big time Broadway people. They'll go and work with a coach as before they even start rehearsing a show, because every score has different demands upon us on your voice. And in my world, I use that template. Every album I do has different demands that it places upon my voice. The Vegas record is very different from vocally from the New York Stories record, which was much more intimate. This is a big, dynamic vocal delivery. It was exhausting when I first started performing these songs live. Oh, my God. I'd be, like, laughing because I was like, I don't have the breath control for this. Like, I just didn't have the breath support to, like, land those big, long notes at the end of the song, you know, like, come back to me, you know, you know, like, no, my band, they were like laughing because I would look at them and go, I can't sing this. And, you know, I tell you, it's all about making sure that you professionally are up to the moment, and you don't ever, I believe in not resting on my laurels and not going, I'm good at this. The artists that keep working on themselves are the ones that keep deepening their art, and therefore they keep deepening what they have to give to their audience.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think as fans, you often think like, okay, you have a voice, you learn how to sing, and there it is. That's kind of the goal, that's the end of the road. But there's so many different styles of singing. There's so many ways that you can use your voice that it's not, as we talked about earlier, it's not the same to sing a cappella as it is to sing jazz. It's not the same to sing jazz as it is to sing hard rock or
That's
do what
right.
Elvis did, you know, and those kind of things. I mean, and Frank Sinatra, I mean, you talk about his vocal control and that kind of thing. I mean, he was radically different than so many others.
That's right. Yeah, and because every singer is built different, like we name checked Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra, two guys whose unerring choices of material, whose incredible diction and delivery of this emotional story of their lyric, like they're unparalleled in the business, but they're both completely different personalities, completely different tone. And they express something really different in the world as personalities. I think they're a really great example of sort of two giants who sort of command very different worlds, but with very similar superpowers, you know?
So, do you have a teaching philosophy then that you employ as a vocal coach?
I do. It's not one size fits all, that's for sure. It's very much artist to artist. I listen to what the singer is doing in their work, and I really try to suss out where I can be the most helpful. If their technique is together, then we don't have to look at their technique. Great. We can look at, you know, how much of their true musical personality is coming through in their delivery. We can look at their emotional commitment to the material. You know, there's ways to deepen how we perform songs. You know, a lot of times coaches don't teach that, so that's one of the things I really enjoy. And then sometimes it's really about getting rid of physical tension or allowing the voice to be free is probably the key thing. But there's no guiding principle beyond, please don't make all the mistakes that I made. So let me be a warning to you. You know, that's kind of my thing. I'm always like, oh yeah, well, here's what I learned. This is the hard way. How about you do the easy way? So that's really why people pay me, is because I am a working singer and I want them to have an easier road than I did.
No, it makes a lot of sense, you know, again, very, very interesting to think about that, you know, because I think, yeah, it's so easy to pay somebody who's just going to teach you the ABCs of how to learn to sing, but to get a working singer is a totally different beast.
Yeah, I would say so because, you know, and also the relationship that I have with my clients can get very intimate to the point of I have a young guy called JP Sachs who's just got signed to Arista Records. He's climbing the Billboard chart right now, and he called me up to come over when he was in Toronto and show me the song that, you know, he was proud of, this and that. And he was showing me all these different songs and sort of going, well, this one's the one that the label wants to release. And I went, really? What about this other one? And he was like, really? You think that's a good one? Because I can make that happen. I'm like, don't take your, you go with your Arista Records team. Don't be listening to me on which single to release. But the relationships get very deep and the trust can get very deep because who else do we as artists go to except for a coach that we've been mentoring us, you know? And that's one of my favorite things is how deep the relationships can get, you know. I love working with fellow artists. It's a real calling and something that really makes me happy.
Is there a moment where you learn from them?
Always. JP Sachs is a great example. We talked career strategy right up until his career signing with Arista. And a lot of the times he would say, I'm about to do a meeting with my manager and an agent and la la la. And here are the three things I'm concerned about. And I'd be like, okay. So I've been in that situation. What am I going to learn here? And I would like hear you hear from people out there in the business on the front line all the time. But more than anything, you know, each individual artist that you meet as a coach is going to show you a different way of being a singer, a different way of being an artist. And so I'm always learning. Like, I'm going to be coaching this afternoon, and I'm working with a jazz singer who's doing her first jazz CD, and she's awesome. And I'm really enjoying the process because, like, I learn more about how you make records and how you put a vocal together and, you know, what to think about. Because, okay, I'm right in there helping her figure out a lot of this, you know, architecture of the record. And that's very fulfilling.
Do you also find then that you're able to learn from not just other musicians, obviously them, and but also just other artists? Like, what other places are you learning from and still managing to put into your craft?
I have been singing with Jackie Richardson these past years, and she's an amazing R&B gospel jazz diva here in on the east side of Canada. And she and I, we've recorded together. We've done, dozens of concerts together, singing duets and singing with each other. I have learned so much as a singer from her breathing, commitment to the lyric, really digging in for what makes a song, what is that emotional piece of life that this song is about. Just really helped me with that, and how to memorize material quickly, how to work with an audience. I've really gotten a lot from her. She's mentored me in a way, and it's been a wonderful, we're dear friends, but it's also a really beautiful professional partnership. We have, I think we're doing some jazz festivals. As soon as everybody comes back, Jackie and I will be singing together again. And she's been a great teacher for me. And, you know, I learn, you know, I would say that's been the most important musical, partnership I've had recently.
Now, we talked, of course, about Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra, but, like, maybe outside of the jazz and outside of the adult contemporary field, like, who are some of those other singers that you look at and you're like, oh, now that's a guy who can sing, or a woman?
Sure. In terms of, who has influenced me the most, I will say that when I was a kid coming up, the soul artists, by that I mean Stevie Wonder, Donny Hathaway, Chaka Khan, and Aretha Franklin were the four singers that I really loved. You know, I just studied their records like crazy. In the jazz world, the other dudes besides Nat and Frankie, certainly Mel Tremé is a favorite. But I've been recently getting into all kinds of guys, like Arthur Prizok is a rich voice baritone, like Lou Rawls, who I love. And in terms of the ladies, you know, besides Sarah, Ella, and Billy, who are sort of the three queens, I listen to Dinah a whole lot. Carmen McRae is probably one of my favorite all-time singers. And, but I will say, I also have listened to rock and roll a lot. You know, I came up in that generation that, you know, went new wave and punk rock. So, you know, I came on the scene with that music. And so people like Patti Smith, who I name checked before, or, you know, the Talking Heads, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, I love ideas in music, and that's kind of what that world was all about. So David Bowie would be the quintessential performer in that regard, and a huge influence on me.
It's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that you had mentioned punk rock earlier, and I was like, what punk rock would Mika be into? Because it seems like I'm a big punk rock fan myself as well. I love all music can have, you know, I mean, you're going to like some more than others, but all music, as far as I'm concerned, has merit as long as even one person likes it.
Yeah.
So, I'm very open. Yeah, I'm a big punk rock fan. So it was really interesting to hear you drop that.
Punk rock is the music of ideas. It's like, here's a series of 3-minute really fast songs that are going to talk about the world as we see it. Bam. And, you know, look at what you know, how the Ramones managed to create a legendary sound just by looking at the American culture around them and saying, this is what we think is fun. This is what we think is cool. I love that.
How I want to sniff some glue.
Yeah. Well, like I was always like, what? And then like you go down to New York City and you like you hang out in Brooklyn or the Bronx and you see the kids that have grown up to be like 65-year-old old demented weirdo rock and roll idiots. And you're like, oh, you're that guy that went to sniff glue with Joey Ramone. You know? Yeah, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's a part of the music biz.
Yeah, doesn't matter what style of music you play, sex, drugs, and rock and roll still is going to enter it into it somewhere.
Those jazz guys? Oh, my God. I mean, I met a lot of those jazz guys from the Charlie Parker days, and, like, it was, you know, if they weren't on heroin and robbing your house to get more, you were lucky.
Yeah, actually, it's very true, because I recently, you know, within the last couple of years, traveled down to Nashville and Memphis and really got into the whole Chitlin' Circuit aspect. And, yeah, reading all about that stuff, and it's just fascinating to see, like, the really, I mean, the, you know, one of the true birthplaces of rock and roll, you know, and that style of music. I mean, crazy stuff, though.
I'm telling you, I once jammed with a band in St. Louis, Missouri, while I was on tour with the Nylons, and it was a bunch of, you know, middle-aged white guys, all, you know, had big guts, and I was like, oh, whatever, I'll go play with them, sure. I was in the club, someone told me, oh, you know, this is the music hang after the concert, come with me. I was like, all right. I got on that stage, and these white crackers were like delivering a groove like you ain't never heard. I was beside myself. And I sang better than I ever sang. I was like, who are these people? And it turns out these were the guys that Ike and Tina Turner were hiring off of them.
Oh.
Right? Chuck Berry, of course. And like they were that's those guys out of St. Louis, Missouri. And they were like the creme de la creme. They just happened to jam in that, you know, joint every Wednesday or whatever it was. I was beside myself. I love music culture. I love the specifics of a area and the kind of music that each area comes up with, you know, in North America in particular, you really get your, you know, and that's what makes touring fun, right?
Yeah, I can well imagine, because it's so true. Like even just like a, you know, 3 hour, 3.5 hour drive from Nashville to Memphis, and it's dramatically different.
Right? Completely. Like you can't even believe how crazy it gets. I love that whole like music travel or music tourism, I guess is what that is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's Brett, I mean, it's like 3 hours from Calgary to Edmonton, and we're totally different. We're cool, and they're Edmonton.
I knew it was going to come up eventually.
Oh, I have to. Pretty much every episode.
Yeah, I could see it coming. I could feel it. You were just dying to get that in there. Hey, and that, you know, unfortunately, I actually have to say goodbye. I've got a 2 o'clock client.
Oh, no, totally understand it. You know, we've had such an amazing time.
Well, what a great conversation. Guys, we got to do this again. Like, you guys you're knowledgeable. Your questions are awesome, you know?
Well, we are ready anytime. But please tell everybody where they can find Vegas Breeze, where they can find you, and of course, you know, when your next virtual tour is coming up.
you know it. So everything Mika, you can find at mikabarnes.com, and that's the easiest way. You'll be able to find everything you need. MikaBarnes.com, you can buy the CD there too, and you know, it's also of course available online on iTunes and you know, Spotify if you're streaming. And in terms of the virtual tour, how about this? How about I get a hold of you guys, and when we're doing our next dates, I'll see if you want to have another conversation, and we can talk about it. It'll either be Europe, or maybe it'll be Canada. We'll see. But it'll be something, because, you know, we're not getting back in a soft seat theater anytime soon.
That is unfortunately true, but I tell you, Mika, I sure look forward to the moment where you do come through Calgary and we do get the chance to see you. Wonderful performer, and really urge everyone to listen to Vegas Breeze. It's amazing. But you have my email and of course on Skype, so please contact us anytime. We love to chat, and we wish you all the best in the future.
And just a heads up, just a heads up for when you come through Calgary. I look like those guys that you got on stage with that Ike and Tina hired.
Excellent. See, you can't judge a book by the cover.
Just way less talented.
Hey, I can dance. Not well. I'm not afraid. It's like Bob Seger said, I may not be good looking, but I ain't shy.
That's a great line. Well, that means that when we see each other, you're going to have to dance for me.
Done.
Awesome, guys. Just hey, listen. On the room. Let me know where this is going to be posted. I want to spread it everywhere.
All right. You bet, Mika. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Had a great time.
It was a real pleasure, guys. Talk to you soon.
All right. Will do. Bye now.
Cheers. I want to take you far away from it all. Down in the desert, there's a place that I know. Just one weekend, we can feel that Vegas breeze.
That Vegas breeze, bringing back sweet memories. The road ahead's a mystery. Fortune calls. Well, the roulette ball may fall. Who knows what the night may hold? There's something blowing in that Vegas breeze. One kiss and magically, well, our tomorrow suddenly became a game for. Never guessed you would stay to play all night. The bang gon' swing, the shots gon' ring, ring a ding till the morning light. We're keeping cool by the hotel pool. It's a great big swinging playground. His stars have brought you to me. The future's ours if you believe that big dreams can come true.